I think it's fair to say that over the past few years in Australia, we've all been shocked by the treatment of greyhounds, by some in the racing industry, by the plight of live animal exports, which appear to be growing, and their treatment at certain destinations, by the treatment of chickens in batteries, about pigs, about animal welfare in general. So when I read a review on a book called The Ethics of Pet Keeping, well, to tell you the truth, I didn't want to read it, having been a keeper of pets for as long as I can remember. Jessica Pierce, the author, asks a question at the start of her work. We love our pets, she writes, so why worry about them? Well, maybe love is not enough. Maybe the 470 million odd animals we call pets also need some moral attention. Their plight may be just as serious and perhaps in some ways even more troubled than the billions of animals caught in the wheels of agribusiness or the biomedical research industry. Jessica is writing about the rather gigantic US pet industry precisely, but she does raise many ethical dilemmas that are much broader than the US. She's a bioethicist and she is a pet keeper, and she joins me from Colorado. Welcome, Jessica.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Look, we should clarify up front that you do have in your household two dogs, a cat, two goldfish, and previously you had a rather large assortment of pets, including rats, frogs, and hermit crabs. So you're not advocating no pets, are you? But to think more about our relationship with them and from their point of view, is that right?
That is exactly right. And I think the fact that I have had so many pets is what inspired me to write the book, because over time, I think particularly as it dovetailed with my professional research interests in animal cognition and emotions and animal welfare, I started to worry about these little creatures in my home. One thing led to another, and that was the origin of the book.
Yes, you started to worry about, I'm just going to list it there, a disposable animal culture, the high mortality rates of animals being warehoused and sold, and the boredom and frustration felt by the animals that spend often their entire life in solitary confinement.
That's right.
Like, and which are you talking about? I mean, which animals? Because you say dogs and cats actually are less of your worry than a lot of the others.
In a sense, they're less of my worry, because I think so many dogs and cats have really good lives, and they have co-evolved with us and are very comfortable in human environments and can thrive in human environments. But given how many cats and dogs there are in homes around the U.S. and around the globe, that's a big problem, too. And when I talk about boredom and frustration, I am thinking about dogs and cats in particular.
And the goldfish. We've just got to get to the goldfish, because
yes.
Tell us why they worry you, the way they're kept.
Well, they began to worry me as I began to notice more and more research emerging on the cognitive lives of fish, including goldfish, and coming to realize that they are sentient creatures, just like the other animals in my home, that they have feelings and experience things like fear and boredom. And, you know, the typical practice, and I admit to having engaged in this, is to have a tiny bowl on, you know, on the dresser in your child's bedroom, because the goldfish is such an easy pet and they cost 12 cents. So there's not a whole lot of financial risk. You have this tiny bowl and the goldfish swims around and around and around. And typically, after a few months, they die, which is highly unnatural, really, for a goldfish. Their lifespan is up to 25 years. So you think, well, something must be wrong with the way we're keeping them if they only survive for such a short time and seem so disposable to people. I don't know about Australia, but in the U.S., you know, goldfish are given as prizes at the fair, and you know, people have goldfish swallowing contests and are really treated as disposable objects, as worth 12 cents.
Yes, and flush down the toilet and so on. You have this very interesting, I think not just you, some scholars have suggested, as you write, that as our relationships with animals become less functional, and this is the really devastating one, that the more that they're integrated into human families, the greater their risk for poor welfare.
Yes.
Now that is counterintuitive.
It is counterintuitive. But if you think about, take dogs, for example, dogs are evolved to do various jobs for themselves or for us, depending on the breed. And when I think of sort of the happiest dogs I know, they're the dogs who live out in, I live in a fairly rural area, and the dogs who are out riding on their all-terrain vehicles with their owners out in the fields and doing farm work or herding sheep. And, you know, in contrast to that, you have so many animals whose only job in life is to lay around the house. And, you know, maybe to us who we have 40-hour-a-week jobs, we think, oh, how delicious just to sit around and nap all day. But if that's all you ever get to do in your life, it's actually pretty boring. And often they're home alone a lot. They don't have any sort of social, I think they're socially starved. They don't have any companionship during the day of whether of others of their own kind or human or, you know, cats and dogs together. They really don't have any meaningful work. And we know from research in, for example, zoo animals and even animals in labs that they need to have meaningful work. They want things to do. And boredom is, for them, it's as much of a problem as it is for us. And if you've been bored, you know it's really an uncomfortable feeling.
I've got one funny friend who says he's just got a lovely dog. He sits around all day and reads books. Because he's a calm, tranquil dog. And I better give him this book. You also talk very much about the pet industry, a thriving industry, particularly in the US. This is really an extraordinary part of your book. You have a 2012 figure that puts the amount spent on pets and associated products as over $55 billion US dollars. And you say it continues to grow. Now, and that it has had a subtle impact on our thoughts in ways that we'll come to. But when did this industry explode? When did it become so big?
It's really been in the last 4 decades in particular. And I think if you know, if you looked at a graph, it would just be an upward climb, a steady upward climb from about 4 decades ago up to now. And as far as I know, I haven't seen 2016 figures. And I did read something that the industry had maybe slightly depressed a little bit, but up until at least the time that I wrote the book, it was extremely strong and growing every year. And you know, not only just in sort of the number of people who are keeping pets, which keeps expanding year to year to year, but also the amount of money people are willing to spend on things like, you know, fancy organic foods and nice water beds and good things like advanced veterinary treatments and so forth.
Yeah, but also you talked about, and this is what really got me, that up until, oh, I don't know, 20 years ago, 15 years ago, we all fed our dogs and cats, well, dogs particularly, scraps from the table. That was considered the thing to do. Good for the dog. It was nice and variety, et cetera, served you as well. And then that's all out now. And you say that that is not an accident. That has been part of a campaign.
I think it has been an extremely clever campaign by an enormous industry. And it's interesting that the pet industry and the pet food industry is intimately linked with the human food industry and particularly the meat industry. And there's this huge sort of a stream of waste from the human meat industry, the things that are aesthetically unpleasing to us, like the noses and the hooves, that are palatable, even probably desirable for dogs and cats and so forth. And so here's this a very clever way to use and make money on this, what otherwise would be waste.
So you also, so we may have fallen for this without even realising it, I suppose. They also advertise in a way that a family isn't complete without a pet, that you teach your children empathy and responsibility by getting a pet. This worries you a lot.
It worries me a lot. And it's, I don't know how it is in Australia, but in the US, it's an extremely strong and pervasive cultural narrative that pets are part of a happy family and that pets are family, which is another thing that concerns me, because what it does is it suggests that pets are well cared for. There's no moral problem. Of course, we know within human families, there's a great deal of dysfunction. There are many levels of sort of subtle violence and coercion that go on. And the same is true with pets as family. But people don't act as if their pets are their family. I talked to a woman in the park one day who went on and on and on about her little Yorkie, who was a member of her family and who she loved more than anything in the world. And then the last part of the conversation, she said, "And then I had to get rid of him. I moved." And I thought, wait a minute. Would you really, if this dog were truly a member of your family, would you speak of him in this way? I mean, I would never say that about my child. I got rid of her. I didn't like the way she was behaving when she was a teenager. So off she went. So we really don't act as though we believe their family.
No, but nevertheless, we are finding more and more remarkable breakthroughs made with troubled youth, for instance. This is growing sort of evidence working with horses or with dogs. It builds a self-regulation in the adult, oddly enough, and I don't think it harms the animal at all.
Yes, and that, I think that's one of the things that's so interesting about the ethics of pet keeping is it's really complex, and there are all of these. It's not just it's a bad thing to do. Obviously not. There's so many positive things about keeping animals as our companions, and you've noted one of them, the therapeutic benefit of animals, and that happens every day on a more subtle level, just the companionship that animals offer to people, not just people who are lonely, although that's a large part of it, people who have lost spouses or whatnot. Animals form an extremely important and intimate part of their life.
So your take-home message to people listening, like me, whom you have rattled with your thoughts, is what?
Well, I would like to encourage people to look at the world from their pet's point of view as much as possible. You know, if you have, for example, a small creature like a gecko who lives his or her entire life inside a glass tank or in a cage, you know, if you don't have one yet, perhaps think twice about getting an animal who will be cage-bound in that way and who really can't have a good quality of life. If you have a dog or a cat, you know, really think about whether you're giving him or her what he or she needs in the way of exercise and social enrichment and
duties, by the sound of it, too.
Meaningful work.
Meaningful work. Jessica, congratulations. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Jessica Pierce, bioethicist and writer, and Run, Spot, Run is published by the University of Chicago Press. And, you know, I did hear that one of the anti-Jewish laws brought in by the Nazis was forbidding Jews of 1930s Europe from owning pets. Isn't that amazing?